to the Complete Agnes Varda. This is episode 13, Kung Fu Master. I'm Matt Gasteyer. As usual, I am here with my co-host, Travis Trudell. How are you, Travis?
I'm doing fantastic, but Matt, there is an exclamation point at the end of that title of this movie. Kung Fu Master! So yeah, it's very important. All the energy comes out while saying that title.
The music in Kung Fu Master is really awesome, and it reminds me of a different, like, 80s video game, but I couldn't place it. But this was like a real game. It was,
yeah,
I guess.
I remember. I never played it. I remember it. I had it on a Nintendo, and I think it was just called.
Came out on Nintendo?
Yeah, I think it was just called Kung Fu.
Okay, I remember that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because I remember when it came out, I used to play that all the time, and yeah, it was super fun, and not as fun as in this movie, because the arcade version, which I never saw, looks way better than the Nintendo right. version did.
Well, and there's also the real life version at the beginning of the movie where Matthew Demme is walking through the streets doing the kung fu.
That was brilliant. I really appreciated that. The opening of that movie really sets the tone for kind of the mindset you're going to be in with when it comes to thinking about his character.
Yeah. So, for sure.
Yeah.
Although at the same time, like, I kind of wish they'd stuck with that real life video game movie through the whole movie.
Want it to turn into a romance, Matt?
Well, here's the question. Like, how do we talk about Kung Fu Master in 2023?
Well,
it's not the easiest thing in the world to get around.
I'm going to quote Agnes Varda when I say, this is a movie of its time. Like, yes. She says that in the introduction, so, like, perfect.
No, but she goes, this is a movie of its time, and I'm like, oh, you mean, like, because you couldn't make a movie about a 14-year-old and a 40-year-old having a romantic relationship, and then she's like, you know, because it's about AIDS in video games, and I'm like, no, that's not what makes it of its time, Agnes Varda.
here's the thing. We can look at this movie two ways. The way I look at it is there's two ways to look at it. We can totally, like, be skeeved out by the content of the plot, which I think is... I had a harder time with this than I did with Lolita, and I really didn't like that movie. I had a hard time with, like, that idea. But then... after I sat down, digested it, started putting my thoughts on paper, the other way to look at it is the really subversive way. You could really put a subversive lens of Le Bonheur on this movie and really see, like, a lot of Varda holding up a, what, you guys like this stuff? Like, mirror up to, like male-dominated society. Like, what? 60-year-old guys are dating, like, 15-year-old girls, 16-year-old girls. You guys had a whole, like, genre of books about it back in the day. Nabokov wrote Lolita, and all of you people took it as literal and not a satire. You know, you can hold that mirror up and be like, look at all this, like, oh, we switch it around. All of a sudden, this is horrible. This is bad. You can, because you got to think. We've talked about it many a times. Varda knows what she's doing. Like, making this story and have it be just kind of plain and it be what it's about, it's never about what it's about. So I had to really, really put on my don't be grossed out by this hat and really kind of dig into a lot of the stereotypical trappings that if switched over... where it's an older male chasing after a younger girl, like American Beauty or, you know, those types of movies where those are heroes or people to look up to as they strive to be young again. You know, like, she's just kind of twisting those things and really kind of showing some of the ways in which women are, you know, just having to deal with things in a more emotionally connected level versus the men who don't, who can remove themselves from these, from, you know, mentally from these entanglements. Matt, what do you think about that?
Okay, so there's a lot there.
There's a lot here, I'm sorry.
And I want to unpack a bunch of it, because I think that there's a lot to talk about with what you've said. The first thing I want to talk about is when you said that you had a harder time with this than Lolita. Why do you think that is? And before you answer, I'm going to give a couple of theories that pop into my head. The first one is just that, like, Lolita is super famous. And, like, there's not, there's just, like, an expectation. It's like, listen, you're watching Lolita. You know what you're getting into. Like, come on, let's just do this thing.
Yeah.
The second one is on along similar lines, but also there is definitely a reading of Lolita that is satirical, but even in the literal manifestation of it that is forced upon the text by filming it, the film never feels like it's on James Mason's side.
Yeah, no. And I agree. I think the reason why it's almost like you can remove yourself from the movie of Lolita because of its fame and notoriety, and because there is, it is pitched humorous in terms of look at this sad sack, look at this stupid quest he's on, look at these men be dumb trying to figure out how to win this young girl who's, who, you know, doesn't know what she's getting into. And then later you have the twist of the tragedy of she knew what she was getting into. She was using them as much as they were using her, but she's the one who ends up poorer for it. But this movie, because the humor isn't there.
Well, and there's an enormous amount of sympathy for Birkin's character.
Completely.
You,
like,
can't argue that away, I think.
No, but there's a weird, I was okay with the movie until Birkin's mom says run away with him to an island.
What the fuck was that?
Dude, that's when I went, wait, what? Like, the mom's not going to talk sense into her? The mom's going to say, follow your heart?
Not just talk sense into her, but like here's a love shack you guys can hole up in.
Here's a deserted island where no one will find you, where you can live your dream of being romantic. Like, I don't see, and I don't know, it's implied they had sex. I don't know. It could be more of a innocent, like, not innocent, but, like, still, like, it could be a really youthful kind of, you know, playing and kissing or whatever. I don't think they did. Well, then the boy's, you know, the boy brags later, which makes me think he didn't. Or maybe he did. Maybe they did on that island. They shared a bed.
It's definitely an open question.
Yeah. Yes. So, like, there is that level of, like, you know, that, you know, once the mom sends her off there, I'm like, oh my God, no one's going to, like, no one's going to stop this. And then they don't, like I just said with Lolita, we focus on the aftermath of things. There's no aftermath here. It's almost like in a voiceover, like, oh, all the kids had to change schools, and I lost the right to have my daughter at home, and they left me with my youngest, and everyone talks about me, and I just stay at home and I read all day. Like, that's basically what she says, and then she has another, like, one-on-one with her daughter where you can see some sort of healing begin to happen. But, like, they focus on...
I do love, by the way, that the mom is Sabi Mamou.
Oh my God, that was great.
From Documentor.
Yep. Yep.
Matthew Demme. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it, yeah, and it's Sabine Mamou who was her Matthew Demme's kid, you know? Yeah. So it's it's great. It is. It works really well. But I just think that because of the nature of what it's dealing with, and it's not handling it as grotesquerie like it does in Lolita, that it makes it a little more confronting, which makes me feel more uneasy about what's going on.
Oh yeah.
I think that's where it is, where like I can be like coolly remove myself from Alita and be like, remember, Travis, this is supposed to be a comedy. Look, Peter Sellers is in this friggin' movie. Like, there's a reason why he's cast.
Yeah.
And this one, I'm just like, why did they think this was a good idea? Like, they literally stopped filming Jane B, which we gushed over last episode, to do this movie and then go back to it. So like, there's got to, like, in my head, there's got to be more to it. So I have to dig in now, and that's where I start picking apart these themes and picking apart right. these concepts. So
the subversive idea that you mentioned, and she's talked about this in interviews, and definitely, I think especially with sort of friendly journalists, have this conception of like, well, you know, this happens all the time in French movies where a younger girl has a affair with an older man, so why not the reverse? I think just like fundamentally I reject that argument. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not you know, one doesn't mean that, like, one, yeah, I guess like two wrongs don't make a right. I don't know, I guess that's the way to put it. I think, like, obviously, you know, it's not an actual relationship, so it is just a movie. So you could argue that by making this movie, she is illuminating the folly of the alternative, like the reversed gender relationship. But I don't see that anywhere in the text. Like, to me, this movie is very much a movie about a woman that is trying to recapture her youth in a very, like, silly and fleeting way, and a boy who is pretty much just like a regular teenage boy getting caught up in the chaos of her midlife crisis.
Yeah.
And that, like, that's okay. That's great. But, like, to make the movie at the same time about this taboo and illegal and very inappropriate relationship, it just, to me, it like taints the rest of what you're trying to say in the movie. I get it's similar. It is somewhat similar to Demi's Donkey Skin, I think, would be the best comparison, because that movie's all about a dad that wants to marry his daughter. And it's like very weird, and you're kind of watching the first half of the movie being like why isn't anybody talking about how weird it is that the king wants to marry the princess? Like, am I, what's going on here? Why is this like a candy coated kaleidoscope fairy tale about incest, forced incest? And you kind of at a certain point have to just say, okay, it's a fairy tale, I guess. And to me, in interviews, and other people have talked about how, like, to kid, like, to me felt like, you know, to kids, it doesn't matter. Like, they don't even think about, and I guess Donkey Skin's like a very common fairy tale in France.
Yeah.
So they don't even think about it from that perspective of like, wait a second, this is super fucked up.
Well, that's a thing, right? Like, when you're kids, I remember when kids are very little, like, and they're figuring this stuff out, you know, they say stuff like, well, when I get older, I'm gonna marry my dad. And you're just like, what? Right. But like, right, as an older person, you're going, no, that's not how that works, and that's really weird. But, you know, as a kid, they're figuring out all these roles and right, how it works. But, you know, yeah, and I understand what he means by that, but also I guess I don't have enough like deep cultural French history to kind of like explain away some. Right. I mean, I know all
that's part of it too,
right? The basics of, you know, older men seeking youth as a means to regain their youth. That's a common theme in lots of literature and lots of movies. You know, just the, you know, two episodes ago we talked about A New Amour, you know, with Sandra Bonner doing that that movie, which is basically, you know, it's kind of, it's along the same lines. And I think the thing that I appreciate the most within this movie, you know, I completely agree. Like, it's whataboutisms. That's what they call it, right? Like, well, I made this, but what about these guys? They made that movie too. So why can't I make my movie? Like, well, no, they made that movie and we all realize it's wrong. So you move on. You don't make your own version of it and then say like, whoa, well, they made it. But you know, and I understand that that's like the weakest excuse ever. But I think putting aside the text of the film, which is a woman trying to recapture her youth by dating a young boy, a teenager, that she totally scams from her daughter's party, and vigorously chases. Like, that was the part that also got me. It wasn't like a bunch of like happenstance that kind of put them in a position, or him chasing her. It was literally like she saw him throw up at a party. She liked the way he looked at her while she was singing to her daughter. And then she went to the school to try to find him, to take him away. And I'm like, ooh, wow. Like, she's going for it. Like, that she was my...
scouts out locations for their video game experience.
Tries to find another video game hall that's further away from the school. So people won't see her with him out in the world, which is like total predatory, like fucked upness. But if we take that business and we call it out for what it is, and now let's put it over here on this shelf, and we look at Varda trying to communicate to us this idea of women and their emotionality about all things, and men and their like Matthew treats this relationship like his video game. It's a series of getting to the next level, and then it's once it's beaten and done, the conquest is over and we just move on. And while everyone else is emotionally tied in knots about all this business, all the ladies that are involved in this, he is very, I'm done with this now, I move on. Which is a very typical male idea of the conquest of ladies, right? Always been that way. I'm going to get this girl, I'm going to woo her, I'm going to bed her, and now that that conquest is over, I've lost interest and I move on to a new video game. I move on to a new girl. And she makes that very clear from the beginning with Matthew as a kung fu guy going down the street. He is living this life. And then you see his obsession with his game. And then he takes it each step further until they're stuck on that island and he realizes that, okay, well, this is kind of, can we go home now? Like, are we done? And they go back, and that's when everything falls out. He goes to his school, and now he has bragging rights to tell the other kids, like, oh, yeah, no, he slept with a housewife, and it was horrible. She wasn't that great. I felt bad for her. And, you know that he's going to carry that story for a while until his next conquest. So it has a very, very pointed, like, point of view in terms of how men function in this world or in that time, and how women function, which, Jane Birkin, Jane's character, is emotionally tied in knots trying to make this work, which, you know, kind of like figuring out ways to make the connections, falling in love with him first, doing all the stuff. You have Charlotte Gainsborough, kind of like awakening, having a hard relationship with her mother, not wanting to share. You could see that she's starting to like Matthew as well. And then, you know, she says, why are you doing this to me? Instead of, why are you doing this? Which is, you know, a super selfish answer, because she's thinking about her emotion and not about anyone else's. So there's all these like points that Varda makes within the movie that support like that lens in which she's viewing things. Because I think if like we looked at Jane Birkin's original script, I bet it was all the plot points. And I bet it's Varda who's injecting all these other nuanced pieces, all these other pieces of work. And it's, I think it elevates sections if you're able to put away the really horrible part, which is, it's hard to do. It's super hard to do, to put away that whole, like, relationship thing. And I don't know how you do that anyway, even as actors. I don't know how you have your son make out with this girl, that this old lady that you've just been making a documentary about, you know, and she, and like, and the way it sounds is she's the one who picked Matthew.
Right. And he was kind of hesitant to do it.
Yeah. And then Varda picked Charlotte Gainsborough to make it even. So everyone's kids are in this movie. It's hard. It's a hard movie. Anyway, that's kind of like how I had to break it down, to be able to kind of really kind of think about the filmmaking aspects of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, the filmmaking aspects of the movie are interesting to me, because this feels like the least stylized or ambitious from a formal perspective film of Varda's career. But it feels very consciously so to me, almost as if it is one of the fake movies in Jane B by Agnes V, where she's kind of taking an idea and executing it in this like matter of fact way that, you know, I mean, this movie's 80 minutes. Like, there's no fat on the story. She's just kind of, like, laying it out there. And part of that, part of it makes it more appealing to me, because there is this kind of, like, sparseness to the narrative. And it fills, I mean, it allows you to fill in a lot in terms of how you're going to interpret this story. But it also just like lays so bare this. I'm sorry, I know we were like putting this on the shelf, but like.
No, we can bring it down anytime we want.
It really is. It's just like, this is what this movie is about, you know?
Yeah.
And there's kind of like no getting around it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like I said, I had to make a conscious effort to push that aside to be able to dig into those themes at all. And I agree, I think this is the most unstylistically Varda film that she's made. There's none of her trademark anything except for voiceover. And it's almost like, it's kind of like in Documentor where she had a limit to how far she can move away from her house. It's almost like she said, we only have this amount of time to make this movie.
Daguerreotypes.
We only have a limited time to make this movie, and then the kids have to go back to school. And so let's strip everything back. Let's make it as simple as possible. We got to shoot it in France. We got to shoot it in England, and then shoot it on this island. Like, we have three kind of locations, and we're just going to, you know, pare it down as much as possible to kind of like
fit
a time frame.
Do you think that she like was going to England for Jane B and filmed this while she was there? Or do you think she wrote in the trip to England? Do you know what I mean?
So she could go to England and go to that island as well?
Well, no, like she like wrote it into the script of this, and then that's why Birkin's parents are in Jane B. Like,
it's so hard because
there's the movies are so intertwined, but they're so different.
Yeah.
So it's like very different, and it's like especially because it's the same kids that you see in Jane B.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just like very difficult to separate the two, and then you've got this one movie that is so much about this woman and her inner life and her struggles with feeling like she's getting older and her life around her, and then you have the fictionalized version of that where she's, you know, unstable and obviously like has issues.
Yeah, and it's almost like taking that that midlife crisis to like a zenith.
Yeah,
like a frenzied zenith of I have to bed this 14-year-old boy so I can feel like I'm young again. And it's a hard pill to swallow.
It's hard for me to like determine what made Varda excited about this. I don't really feel like she's talked that much about it. Like
it may have been a simple only way to get Birkin to continue with all the other stuff she wanted her to do for the other movie. Like, well, let's shoot this movie that you've always wanted to shoot, or you know, you wrote this, let's make it, this will be fun, let's do it together. And I don't know,
because this hard. Is her money. Like, that's
she lost she lost all of her money, all the money. Yeah. She made from Vagabond,
right?
They lost in these two movies. Neither of these movies made money,
right?
They didn't even make it over to the United States, neither of them.
Well, this one did, and it got a vicious review in the New York Times. It's really interesting to me just how poorly Varda's movies were consistently reviewed in the New York Times. I think with the exception of Vagabond, pretty much every movie that we've covered that was released in the U.S. got a mediocre to poor review when it was released here in the New York Times. Like, even Cleo was like a mediocre review in the initial response. And the Kung Fu Master, did you read the Kung Fu Master review?
I didn't read the review.
It's by Karen James, who's
okay.
Sort of a semi-regular high profile critic. At one point she says, Kung Fu Master, which opens today at Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, is much too stupid to be offensive.
Wow.
And I think it kind of goes downhill from there. She refers to Varda's long, uneven career. But I think like, it's very striking that these movies just had no footprint whatsoever after the huge success of Vagabond. It just doesn't seem like they connected with anybody, even in France. And you do have to wonder like what people thought of these movies, because they are, I mentioned on the last episode, like, I just don't know as an American person if we can kind of know what the French response would have been to Jane B, because it is it's about a woman who has a very different profile and reputation in France in the late 1980s than in the US in the early 2020s.
Yeah.
And this movie similarly, like, because of the politics of today, the perceptions of today, the mores, in particular in the U.S., like, I just feel like we are so far removed from what people in late 80s France would have thought of this story, and like how receptive they potentially would have been to a movie like this. And like, you know, keeping in mind that 15 years earlier, Mall had made Murmur of the Heart about a boy who has a incestuous relationship with his mother. You know, that's just one of the many French movies that you can point to that have similar kind of stories to them. So there is kind of like a sense of, well, maybe we're just not getting this.
Yeah, you know, that's a, this could be, 100% a cultural thing that it just wasn't, you know, with our puritanical foundation over here in the United States, you know, it could be completely just so foreign to us, it's hard to think about it in terms of comparison. But it's something that I, you know, there's an interview on the Kung Fu Master disc portion underneath the subheading on the Varda, Complete Varda. It's on like a talk show, like a dinner party talk show, where everyone's being like eating and being served drinks while they're on a stage having a conversation. And Jane Birkin looks so uncomfortable there, or like she's high as a kite, and like just like she's, some of the things she's saying make no sense. Some of the humor is falling flat. Varda looks uncomfortable, and the way they, in every interview they talk about it as like a fun family time capsule of their children at a beautiful age, and I'm just like, but isn't it marred by your son having to make out with that lady? Like, doesn't that kind of like, you know, oh, here's our trip to Niagara Falls and it was great, but why is every picture with him making out with his aunt? It was the interviewer had a really, didn't know what to make of this either. Like, you could see him skirting around the questions and, like, being really light with everything, but not, but, like, you know, just always steering it back to Jane B. Par Agnes V. Like, always kind of, like, steering it around, which I find it interesting that they included this on the Kung Fu Master set, because they spend most of the time talking about the other movie. But there is a brief aside. There's this great part. You know, last week the three of us talked about how the Serge Gainsborough part where he's standing over her shoulder trying to get her to like to sing this song and like blowing smoke in her mouth and like just how like awful that was and how like intense that is. The interviewer in this says this great line. There's this really poignant moment where Serge is is like working on you with us on a song, and I'm like, poignant. Who the hell, like, is this bad translation? Who thinks that's poignant? Like, that was, like, so brutal. It felt so, like, controlling and, like, just claustrophobic. I don't know how you're viewing that as poignant, but it was very funny. But, I don't think anyone knew what to do with this. And I think that's why it kind of, like, languished and just disappeared. And I think it actually wouldn't surprise me if it marred the Jane Birkin documentary due to his association, because, you know, the way they talk about it and the way they bring it up and then, you know, they go ahead and make a movie about it, it it wouldn't surprise me if it kind of like it had ripples that caused the other one not to do so well, because I assume they traveled together, those two movies. I mean, they had the same poster. Like, they shared a poster almost.
Yeah, although it's interesting because this release was definitely just this movie. I don't even know if she references, actually, the documentary. I don't think she does. It is interesting. It also had a main title at the time, which was A Mama's Boyfriend.
Ooh.
Kung Fu Master.
No, stop that.
Yeah.
That didn't say that, did it?
It did, yeah.
Ugh, that's horrible. A Mama's Boyfriend. Oh, man. I really like the scene where they're having a party under the tarps at the beginning, and there's all these young kids, like, talking shit, and, you know, these girls giggling. She did a really good job of capturing that weird youthful energy, the teenage energy.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that.
There's also the scene with her and her friend at the like graphic design office, where her friend is talking about like what it's like to have a teenage boy in your house.
Yeah.
Which to me, well, first of all, like as somebody who's about to have a teenage boy in that in their house, like I definitely related significantly with what she is saying. But also like feels a lot like the key to the whole movie in terms of like what she's saying and also what Birkin is saying about, you know, how boys are, what, I don't know, I forget exactly what she says, but like sensitive and have a certain mischievousness to them. I don't know, she says
something. Oh, like yeah, well, she's super like super overly forgiving, like the mom is like right. has valid complaints like right. about how they're animals, they're little beasts, and it's hard to deal with them. And like Jane is like putting the rose tinted I'm in love with a young boy glasses and trying to apologize or interpret what those things are when really it's that's her perspective of that feeling. And that scene also, like, besides being the, like, I agree with you, I think that's a big key to it, because it's almost like she's confusing this desire to be with a 14-year-old boy with the desire to have had a 14-year-old boy yep. as a child.
I think like, that the fact that she has two girls is like totally a part, like a big part of this entire concept from the beginning, like her sense of like the fact that the only way that she's related with teenage boys is in a romantic context, and she has this sense of like, you know, wanting to be their mom, but also it's impossible to like separate her previous experience from that maternal desire.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's a confusion there going on with her not being able to understand that maternal instinct and, you know, instead of projecting it on the boy as a maternal, she is confusing it with her only other experience with teenage boys is when she was a teenage girl. So,
no, and when she says, like, you know, when by the time you're shaving, I'll be gone. Like, that's a parent perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the idea of like when your kid grows up, they no longer have a use for you.
Which is also creepy. That because
that's
can
what
also
I was just gonna say. Like, it's like it, I, it's as I'm creepy. Saying it, it's like it's all it like is equally yeah. icky because it's like
I won't like you anymore when you get older because you're not 14-year-old boy anymore.
Right, but also it's like I'm making out with somebody that I want to be my son. So yeah. like, does that make it better? I don't think that makes it better.
Well, yeah,
that actually maybe makes it worse.
Oh, completely. And you know, in those shots of them in England together. Like it's like a big family running around,
yeah, totally
joking
yeah,
with
she's
the little
making the eggs, yeah, to the whole family,
yeah, having a good time, and then yeah, then she gets caught making out with the boy in the bathtub by her daughter, and
she's a terrible liar. I mean, she's really
horrible.
Bad at it.
Horrible. Well, she's not even trying. It's almost like she's. It's almost like she's willing it to be like open, like to see kind of like if she's like if people were okay with this. And then when the mom gives her permission to go run off on an island, I'm like, what are you doing? No, you're supposed to not give like you're not supposed to give permission. Are you like you want that too? Is that what you want? Like, oh my goodness, this whole family, what's wrong with you?
What about the AIDS stuff?
That is, I wish that was more subtle. It's so like forward and injected in the movie, which it's almost like, you know, they have so many of the AIDS jokes that the boys are telling.
Can we talk about those for a second? Because It's not the same joke, right? So they come up with a different joke that's like almost identical. I'm just really impressed with anything like that, because it's a play on words, but I think it's a play on soda,
right? Yes,
in French.
Yeah, because it's a
lemon and lemonades in the subtitles, and the same thing with the like ass injected.
Yeah, because the way they spell it, it's SIDS, SIDAS or something like that.
So it's the
person who had to translate to make those jokes work. I'm sorry and thank you for doing that for us. Yeah. Oh, it's a real pretzel. That's tough. It's hard, because just when you're like, okay, kids are stupid, this is the 80s, these jokes would fly, jokes about homosexuality and dropping the F word. Okay, sure, 80s. But then Matthew's Nazi helmet that he wears while drawing a caricature of Hitler for a school project. And that's when I'm like, wait a second, what else is going to... Was this also a thing? It was, like, in that punk period in England in the late 70s, early 80s, fascism and Nazi propaganda. I think
both of those things, like both the jokes and the Nazi stuff, is like very much just like teenage boys love the taboo and they love to push the boundaries.
Yeah.
And I think both of those things are just like underscoring his immaturity and like the fact that, you know, there is just like a flippancy to when you are 14 and you can, you know, trade clothes for what's the thing that he has?
A pocket calculator from Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he can look like Columbo.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of that tone she nails really well. Like she lives with that boy. Like, that's her son. I'm sure these are those things that she's had to deal with that she put directly in the script. It would not surprise me if that literally is his helmet that he has also to be, to be that challenging.
I was even wondering if that conversation between the two women was a conversation that Varda and Birkin had had with each other, where Varda was like, oh, you like, let me tell you, you wish you had a boy. Let me tell you what it's like to have a teenage boy.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. It would make perfect sense. And I think it's fine. That was another part that kind of like, I was like, okay, she's a graphic designer, so she's an illustrator. And then Matthew, the 14-year-old, is really good at art, but they don't make a big deal out of that at the same time, which I thought was, I was like, okay. But they never talk about it. It's not like the two of them are sitting there drawing together and that's a connection or something that puts you on another level of kind of like, okay, maybe they are. Going back to that idea, that concept of a substitute for a family member, it holds complete water. It almost feels like false. And then it even becomes playing house when they go out to the island. Instead of being a son, he becomes a husband.
Yeah.
And, that's their little girl. And, there's... that also doesn't work. It's like all the means in which she's trying to shoehorn him into her life, none of them are working out the way that she wants, because she really doesn't know what she wants, which really is to just connect with her daughter and share with her stuff, because they're kind of, you can tell that at the beginning, like every time she tries to pry and talk to her daughter's like, I'm not talking to you about that stuff. I know what you're doing. You think you share with me that I'll start open up and start sharing everything with you? Well, it's not happening. And so it's almost like she just wants someone to share that youthfulness with, and her daughter's not giving her that fix. So she goes searching for it in Matthew's character.
In A romantic relationship with an underage child.
Oh. I did like when they were all dressed in seaweed on the beach. I thought that was great.
I loved some of the sweaters in this movie. There's some really great sweaters mm-hmm. on both of them. I mean, the other thing about the AIDS thing is obviously, like, Demi died of AIDS a couple of years later. I don't know if he had AIDS at this point. But it just feels very noteworthy that she made a movie where that was so prevalent throughout in this time period.
Yeah, I think, I mean, most of her movies, she picks, there's a subject that interests her, and so she puts it in her movies to discuss it more, to get information out there. But it's very, you know, from the jump, we have the TV talking about AIDS and the public service announcement. And then moving on to, you know, people passing stuff out in the street, the boys making fun of it in the playground, making those jokes, the condom.
There's ads. There's lots of ads everywhere.
So yeah, many ads.
Stuff. Yeah.
Condoms being passed. There are condoms in magazines, like free sample packets of detergent or a cologne. It was, you could see that there was a very large push to kind of I remember
condom mania. Did you
oh yeah
those yeah
yep I remember all that stuff. Like I remember all the PSAs, all the celebrities coming out and having conversation. When Magic Johnson comes out and starts talking, it was a huge crisis that fortunately, you know, seemed to, you know, besides all the negative connotations and the othering of people who had it, I mean, it seemed to raise the awareness to the point where numbers have reduced and, you know, stuff like that. And so I assume it did that also in France and in England where we see this. But it is a really pointed message. I mean, especially when we're talking about, you know, forbidden love and then the results of love, you know, that as the girl was saying, are you willing to die for love? You know,
right.
Putting yourself out there to try to have sex with a 14-year-old boy. At
I mean,
40.
That's the thing where I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to that. Like, AIDS is different than having sex with a 14-year-old boy.
They're both like, dangerous, Matt. Like, they're both dangerous.
It's just like, let's draw that line between like disease that people get through no fault of their own and pedophilia. I feel like we can separate those two things maybe.
The movie's called Kung Fu Master, Matt. It's not pulling punches. It's not being subtle. It's trying to break bricks here. It's there's no subtleties here. Like nothing is. It's all of her tools aren't as are very dull at this point, and I don't know why. Like she could have done something more with this, but I honestly do think it's a lot to do with the amount of time she had. And it wasn't her idea. Kind of went half-baked into it and tried to make something out of it. But she threw away all of her tools in which she would be self-referential, meta. She got rid of all those things that she usually uses. And I think that's also why it's so jarring. It's just, like, it's so there. Like, this is it. Like, there's nothing deep, you know. You can try. I did put some stuff in here, but it's really... the sum of its parts do not overshadow the glaring thing in the middle of this plot that is really hard to swallow.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is for me, like, I don't dislike this movie.
I agree.
It's just very difficult to talk about without getting to the elephant in the room. And I guess when I think about like what I do like about it, somewhat ironically, because it's also kind of what makes me the most uncomfortable about it, is its gentle nature. There's a naivete to the way that the story's being told that I think is intentional, because she doesn't want you to think too hard about the relationship. She wants you to take it at face value in terms of it being about this woman who is trying to recapture her youth and, struggling with feelings of motherhood and other elements of being a woman. So, you can kind of get invested in their small moments that they have together.
Yeah, I mean, 'cause if it's too flagrant or grotesque, you would lose you would lose it completely. Like you lose your interest in the film. And I think you're right. I think it, you know, it almost keeps it so subtle that you don't feel like, well, some people might not feel like there's anything really wrong with what's going on. I'll give you an example. So I was watching this movie last night, and my son got home from soccer practice, and he was eating a bowl of cereal and watching the movie with me. He came in halfway, so he's like, "What's going on?" And I explain, and he's like, "Really?" And then we get to the part in the bath, in the pool at the English house, and they're kissing in the pool, and the daughter walks around and cries, and there's a whole to-do, and my son says, why is she so upset? What's the big deal?" And I go, "Well, you know, he's 14 and she's like 40." He's like, "So they like each other." And I go, "Joaquin, if you came into the house," his best friend is named Adam, "if you came into the house and your mom was making out with Adam, wouldn't you be like, 'What the fuck?'" And he goes, "Oh my God, I totally would be freaking out." I go, "Well, that's just what happened here. That daughter comes around and the mom's making out with her school friend who's 14." He goes, "Oh, okay, yeah, no, that's not cool. No, that's not cool at all." And I'm like, okay. So it took the 12-year-old like to point out like how to make it personal for him to understand it. But for that one brief second, he's like, "What's so wrong about this? They like each other." And, you know, which I think really points out that naivete part that you're talking about. It's very subtly done.
Well, and that's always like, I mean, when you're a teenage boy, like, what better thing than to get some hot older mom action, you know what I mean? But like,
It's all
that's
over the place.
part of the problem. Like,
Yeah.
and it's this is true with teenage girls too. Like dating the cool guy in his 20s that has a car, and sure, his job is to deal drugs, but like he's got a steady job that he holds down. Like, this is a cool guy,
Yep. No,
you think, because you think of yourself as an adult at that age, even though you're completely not.
it's a stereotype for a reason. Like it exists, it happens. I mean, what's that joke about the kid who had sex with his high school teacher? He died from high-fiving to death. You know, it's like that kind of it's that idea. And if for years it's always been that way where it's wrong for the girl to want to you know with a male teacher, but for a boy to conquest a female teacher, it's totally cool. It's a
Yeah,
thing. It
he must have
yeah.
the right moves.
Oh, and there's a whole slew of 80s movies in which that is the whole theme. Rob Lowe started a few
Literally
of them.
all the right moves, right?
Yes, all the right moves. Exactly, all the right moves, and Risky Business, and there's so many of them of just a high school kid having sex with an older lady as a Private Lessons, I think there's one.
Well, yeah, and American Pie.
Yeah, American Pie, Stifler's Mom, like that whole thing. It's ingrained in our culture that that is acceptable, but to have the woman chase after the 14-year-old, like, shoes on the other foot, and now it's like, whoa, that's not cool. But at the same time, you've got an Academy Award-winning American Beauty about a dad hitting a midlife crisis and wanting to have sex with a 16-year-old girl in his high school. You know,
he comes off poorly in that movie, though, to be fair.
Well, he does come off poorly, but, you know, it's still...
She's definitely sexualized, though, for
sure. Completely. It should be a repugnant idea to begin with, but, you know, just like so many other movies, like, people glom onto the things they want to take away from it. And, you know, there's something still at the end with him being dead and talking from beyond the grave. There's a weird nobility in his coming to the realization that he made the wrong choices in life. You know, that's fucked up. Like, yeah, you made the wrong choices in life. You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have been going for that. That's not a goal.
Yeah, I was talking about Manhattan with my wife earlier today.
Mariel Hemingway.
Movies. Yeah, and, you know, it did make me wonder, like, what if he was 17 in this movie? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would I have had the same, like, dramatic reaction to it? And it's still wrong. Like,
yep.
But, I mean, the other thing is, like, he hasn't gone through puberty yet, this kid. Like, he looks very young. And it's just, like, from a visual perspective, uncomfortable. But then there is also, like, the flip side of that, which is, like, all these movies and TV shows that cast women who are 19 and 20 and 21 to play teenagers and then sexualize them. Or, you know, I remember when, like, Jessica Biel was in Seventh Heaven and then she was on, like, the cover of magazines super sexualized, and it's like, well, she plays a ninth grader on a TV show. Like, is this really what we want, you know, to be out there?
That's what we do here in America. Sex sells. We have to do that. Everything. I can think of the girls from Glee doing a really racy thing together, and they're also supposed to be high school, and that's part of that that male fantasy getting together with your high school, cuz in all it is it's sex nostalgia. It's, you know, it's your comic books, it's your ALF, it's your TV shows, it's your 80s, it's your 90s. It's remembering what it was like to be that age and wanting to do that, and then unfortunately foisting it upon the youth of that age, which is, it's not your place to do that to them. They're going to have their own memories and their own things. It's forcing your perspective on a whole demographic of kids because your memories and how important they are to you, which, you know, is part of the problem. A lot of selfishness in the world.
Is there selfishness in this Birkin character? I mean, I think completely. Intentionally putting that onto her.
Yeah, I mean, she's ignoring her children. I mean, she literally goes to pick up her daughter from school and grabs the boy instead and just leaves her daughter there to walk home. And then her daughter says, I saw you coming to school the other day. I thought you were coming to pick me up. And then you just disappeared. And she's like, oh, yeah, I had to talk to a teacher and then I left. And so, like, she's totally selfish about it. There's a scene, and I thought it was, you know, my heart sank because I thought something was going to go horribly wrong. There's a scene where the littlest daughter, when they're out on the island, is by herself on the beach by the breakwater crying, and no one's around. And I'm like, oh, is this the part where that girl dies in the water? Like, you know, she drowns, like, because they're not paying attention to her and they're having their trysts. Is this how this is going to end? And they realize they've made a mistake. And, you know, it doesn't happen that way.
Varda's not going to do that. She might imply it.
Yeah, and so having her be there crying, I think it's completely selfish, you know, bringing the boy to London to meet her family, which is fucking
delusional.
Deluded. Yeah. So, yes, I do think it's selfishness, because that the only way you make decisions like that is out of pure selfishness. Like, there's no greater good being served here. There's no altruism in trying to nail a 14-year-old boy.
Do you think that Varda then is, you know, drawing a parallel between the whimsy and not whimsy, but like, you know, complete emotional immaturity of Julian and Mary Jane's own emotional immaturity? Like, he's, you know, into her 1 minute, wants to talk about Dungeons and Dragons the next. Like, is this just her revealing her own immaturity, or?
I think, see, this is where if you put this stuff up on the shelf and you kind of can dig into some of Varda's ideas that she has in it. I mean, having that conversation about Dungeons and Dragons is basically just about pretending and like putting on an act to be this thing, which they're doing on that island at that moment where she's, you know, she's pretending to that they're all alone and that they're in this adventure where they're together, because they talk about having an adventure and going on a desert island.
Yeah, and it is interesting because he says, like, you know, it's all the adventures happen in your head.
Yeah, and which is everything that's going on there is, like, Birkin's brain is the one who's putting all these pieces together, and the boy is into it. But like I said, as soon as he's accomplished what he's trying to accomplish, as soon as he hits the level he's trying to reach, he's out and it's over. And it doesn't, like, it'll affect him later in life. I'm sure he's going to have, like, some really fucked up, like, sessions on a couch with someone trying to work out all this stuff that happened. But in the moment, you know, he's able to turn it off pretty easily, you know. And I don't know if that like moment where he, you know, he goes to the bartender and says, "Hey, could you call this lady? I'm not allowed to call her. But if you could call her and let her know I saved Sylvie, she'll know what, you know, what it means." Like, is it his, like, it's almost like being proud to share something with your parent, not like, you know, not like to share something with your girlfriend. And he's aware enough to know that I'm not allowed to call her. Like, it's a rule. Like, this has happened. So I do think, see, this is where I want to give credit to Varda. And that's why I say these things, like, you know, she's working in these realms of doing this and doing that and setting up these characters to have these, you know, I want to give her credit and try to, like, pull this fucking fiery wreck from a tailspin. You know, like, oh God, she did this. She's doing this for a reason. But it's like we said, it's hard to put that aside. It's hard to put that away. So I do think there is some moments of things that she wants to get off her chest in this movie, especially when it comes to 14-year-old boys and this idea of the folly, because the folly of trying to chase youth, because she says, like, you know, the whole impetus for the Jane B. Agnes V. movie is Jane Birkin's talking about how pretty soon she'll be 40 and how horrible that is. And Varda's like, no, 40 is a great age to be. And it's almost like, here, let me make this movie about showing you how ridiculous you look chasing after a 14-year-old boy and how stupid this all is and how it's never going to mean anything to them and you're just going to ruin your life and their life. And, like, it's all a game. Like, none of it matters. You can easily go occupy yourself with something else that'll be much more satisfying than actually trying to recapture this former glory. And, you know, it could easily be a didactic lesson like that. but it's not satirical or grotesque enough to make it feel like it, that's the point. So it's hard to take it. It has that softness that you talked about that makes it feel like this is something real that's happening.
Yeah, and like Lolita, you know, when you write about something on the page, and it seemed like her story was a little bit more, like, it kind of seemed like it stopped at the end of the party. Like,
yeah.
It was really more about, like, her feeling this both maternal but also romantic connection to this younger kid who was getting shit-faced at the party because he was, like, out of place and trying to look bigger. But when you do that on the page, it's one thing. And then when you try to film it and make it literal, it just becomes something entirely different. And it's hard to get away from what people are watching on screen and to get to the subtext of something.
Yeah, I think a deft writer could easily tell that as a short story and have those lines being blurred and make it poignant and thoughtful and thought-provoking. But as soon as you take it out of your brain and actually physically show it, I mean, I'm super grateful there isn't a sex scene in this movie. So grateful. Yes. So grateful. And I know that Varda's never been one to kind of put that stuff on screen, but at the same time, you know, who knows? But yeah, I definitely think that you're right about the written word. And I think that, like we said earlier, I think that, you know, Jane Birkin had this idea and this concept and Varda kind of ran with it and made it a little bit more her own, for sure.
Is there anything else you want to cover on this one?
I think we've covered it all, except for the unrealistic expectation of ladies thinking you're super cool because you're good at video games. I think that set up a false expectation for years to come of guys thinking that playing video games and really being good at them is what gets the ladies hot. I always found that part fascinating. She's just like, he's so good at the game. Like, that's like a mom being excited that your kid is good at something. Like, that, like, just so, so weird, the interweavings of those things, this misplaced emotion she has for Julian. But, yeah. No, I think we've covered everything the best we can. I mean, it's a hard one. You know, usually we like to bring people with a different perspective on the show, but I didn't want to bring someone who was a pro this movie.
You know, like a NAMBLA.
A NAMBLA. Yeah. Let me tell you all about Man-Boy Love. No.
I mean, we didn't mention much Charlotte Gainsbourg, who is...
She's amazing in this
very
movie.
Good in this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I can see how she could move. I honestly didn't know she acted in her youth. I don't know where all of a sudden she's in Lars von Trier movies. That's all I knew her from.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I really didn't dig deep into her past. And it's pretty amazing. Like, she did a really good job. She's very effervescent, very light, very... she's a joy to look at on screen because she always seems like she has like a secret and she's smiling and then even when she's being like pouty and spiteful at her mom about things, you know, even then it's almost like with a playfulness that kind of like, you're not getting my secrets from me, I'm keeping these things. And when she gets emotional at the scene at the end, when she finds them in the bath, in the pool. When I say viewers, when I say pool, if you haven't seen this movie, it's not a pool.
It's not it's a like swimming a, pool.
It's a cement bathtub in the in the yard. You know, she really puts a lot of emotion in that scene, and it's she does a really great job. Like, you know, I really liked her. She was probably my favorite part of this movie. I was always happy when she was in the scenes because then we weren't watching the romance. Yeah, no, she was great.
My favorite parts were the Kung Fu Master parts.
It makes me want to play that video game, and I think I have it on the. I think it's downloadable on the Switch in the Nintendo. If you have the Nintendo NES subscription, you can play it on the Switch.
You gotta save Sylvia.
Gotta save Sylvia. You gotta beat the dwarfs and the knife throwers.
So Kung Fu Master. Where are you putting this one? Oh wait. We didn't talk about Beautiful Stairs.
Oh,
we
yeah.
Said we were going to talk about
that's
it
right.
this time.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
It was wonderful. I love that it's a tribute to stairs in movies. Like that whole thing is fascinating. And like,
yeah, well, and I love that like it's just Varda is so good at those, like, I'm going to show you a whole bunch of scenes with stairs in them, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to show you a bunch of guys touching their face. Like, whatever it is. Like, shit. And so for her to be able to, like, do that, which is so classic Varda in a way that was applicable to the short that she was making, I thought was really appealing.
I liked it, too. And I think my favorite, I read a Letterboxd review where someone wrote, Isabella Johnny, gasp. Agnes Varda, gasp. 2 minutes later, what? I didn't know that they were only going to be just in this short and that's it. I like that. I like that she got her to come and be on the stairs of the Cinematheque and have that moment.
If I was 14 and was going to have a romantic relationship with an older woman, I would prefer it was Isabella Johnny. That would be very high up on my list of older ladies to make out with in the pool.
It would still be creepy, Matt. How dare you sully her?
I think that's
by
like
foisting your youth upon her.
I think that those like sessions would be worth it for me.
Yeah.
I also really loved the like graphic at the end that was it was like free you like you get a free wink from the from like the box office person or the cashier girl.
Oh, have you mentioned this?
Yeah. the first 10 customers.
That's such a great like promotional gimmick too, right? Yeah. If you see this, the first 10 customers get to Yeah. That's so fun. Yeah, no, I thought it was nice. I didn't do enough digging, but I'm wondering if that was part of a national promotional thing where people were kind of like writing about their cinemas or filming short films about it or something like that.
Or well, no, I think it was for the 50th anniversary.
Was it?
Of so the were Cinematheque.
Yeah, were there other filmmakers doing things?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know about that.
See, I wish they those are those things that I wish they would collect sometimes because I really like those. Way better than the Varda photo one where it was the same entry over and over and over again.
There's some good stuff in that.
The other thing
I liked about this was just like I have that same feeling. Like I have like a deep connection to the outside of the Harvard Film Archive, not just being inside of it, but like there's that feeling when you get to a movie or when you're leaving a movie, you know, that is very personal.
Completely.
And so like it didn't just feel like a gimmick to me. Like it was very much like I'm sure she was just thinking like, okay, how do I make a movie? You know what I really love is walking up those stairs and walking down those stairs. It's part of the ritual.
And leave it to her to kind of find the, you know, the most oddball thing that she enjoys that makes it so personal to her.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. No, I agree, because the whole, like, going to the movies, going to your favorite movie theater, going to, like, you know, your spot in the cinema, like, it's such a great feeling. It's visceral. You know that you're walking into the space. Like I feel that way when I go to Somerville Theater, when I go to the Arlington Capitol, when I go to the Brattle. There's a whole like mindset as you're entering the space and like going up into the theater or going down into your seats that it gets you going and getting you ready for a movie. And the people who rush in and kind of aren't paying attention and don't take that moment to kind of like enjoy settling into the experience, it's makes me sad.
Yeah, it's so true. I just I try to get like early to the movie theater whenever I go. I mean, especially to like Brattle or Harvard Film Archive, just so I can like walk around, sit there, think about how excited I am, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's the best. Yeah, like just the whole theater experience is the best.
Yeah. So where are you going to slot this one? And remember, this is not based on how uncomfortable the sexual dynamics make you feel.
Well, of course, it's of course I have to put that into play. I can't. That's like throwing all the baby out with the bathwater. She's doing nothing new with this, and it's not like it's such a straightforward tale, but the plot is the crux of the movie. I read a Roger Ebert review, and his tagline about this movie was "A young boy's coming of age." Gosh. I was like, wow, that's one way to look at it, I guess. But all right, so if I'm gonna slot this somewhere, and unfortunately it's way down at the bottom. I really like the subject matter. I try putting it aside the best I can and just watch it as a film, you know, and I tried really like pulling out gender dynamics out of it. And I tried pulling like all this like stuff that it could be about and it could be more about. And it still left me with just an older woman trying to feel young by messing around with a young boy. And it never like in it going too far. Like when they went out to the island, that's when I was just like, okay, this is stepped over the line. It's like kidnapping now so she can have her tryst. It's very weird. So at the bottom still is Nausicaa, followed by Kung Fu Master. Then La Pointe Court, Creatures, Murmurs, Lines Love Lies, Daguerreotypes, Documentor, Jane B., Cleo, One Sings, Vagabond, Les Bonheurs. It was super hard for me to like not have this movie taint Jane B. Because that one was such a joy to watch, like all the experimentation she was doing, playing with all the playing with the tropes and the look of a movie about a famous actor, and knowing that this like gestated within this in that movie made me go, well, does Jane B really need to stay up there? But no, it does. It's a beautiful movie on its own, and Kung Fu Master really didn't sit well with me.
Yeah, I'm gonna put this in the same place as you, just above Nausicaa and before Les Creatures, for a lot of the same reasons. I think if you think about Kung Fu Master as sort of an extended version of the made-up movies in Jane B, it works a lot better for me.
Like, yeah,
if it's in the within the universe of that movie, okay. But as a standalone movie, I think it definitely suffers from the misguided components of it, and also the fact that I think it's just ultimately not as interesting as the vast majority of her other work.
I agree 100%. I think it would probably might be better off that way, like if it was another movie directed by someone else that was in her fantasy over of her career. I think you're right, putting that prism on it makes it a lot more palatable, but it's still really creepy. All right.
Well, Matt, next time, what do we got? We are going into much less creepy territory for a film that I have yet to see, which is Jacques Audenant, which is a sort of biopic or it's a true coming of age movie about her husband Jacques Demy.
All right, well, I think, Matt, with that, we're complete for another week.